The following episode contains no Keanu Reeves chat whatsoever. I just really like this intro, and I missed it.
I know Kung Fu.
FBI!
If the bus blows up, he wins.
Whoa. Excellent!
What's up, fools? It's your boy, Ben Hyten. Here, flying solo, just as I promised, as I've done for the last few years, letting you know what some of my top movies of 2022 were. Obviously, not best, because what does best really mean? How can you compare a film like Avatar The Way of Water to, I was going to say Pinocchio, I don't know. Art is subjective. Anyway, there are obviously objective technical things that you can achieve with a film. This is not necessarily what I think the best films of 2022 were. They're just the ones that I liked the most, the ones that have stayed with me, the ones that I may revisit in coming years, some of them I may never revisit again. And as Jeff Canata of the Filmcast and DLC will always tell us, this list is based on an incomplete sampling. So let me start by saying, here are some films that I did not see in 2022, and that may be because they were not released where I live in Britain, or it may be because I just didn't get around to seeing them. So not included in this list by virtue of me not having seen them are The Fablemans, Tar, Empire of Light, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, or anyone's Pinocchio, to be honest, that came out this year, The Whale, She Said, Women Talking, After Sun, Decision to Leave, Triangle of Sadness, Terrifier 2, Babylon, Don't Worry Darling, Bones and All, Armageddon Time, and Bardo, and frankly with that last one, I had no intention to. Probably half of those got a good chance of being in the top 10 of the year. A lot of them just simply haven't come out here until 2023, so I won't get around to seeing them. But they may end up in my 2023 list. And some of them I just didn't get to see. Decision to Leave, I'm really annoyed that I didn't get to see that one, for instance. And before we get into the list of what I actually did like, actually before we go any further, there's two films that I only saw in 2022, but they were released here in 2021, that I just want to mention very quickly. Petite Maman by Celine Sciamma, who is, I've seen three of her films, I don't know if she's done more than that, but they're all five-star films in my opinion. Girlhood, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and Petite Maman. Petite Maman feels especially special. I'm not saying it's the best one necessarily, but it's, I think, 77 minutes long. It's a U-certificate movie, and it, in that time, with very little dialogue, it achieves way more than what a lot of other films can achieve in twice that runtime, and maybe even more. I thought it was absolutely beautiful from the first minute to the last. I think it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous film. And for me, although obviously I am not a mother or a daughter, I don't know how obvious that would be necessarily, but for me, it's one of the best films about maternal love that I can remember seeing. And the other film that I want to mention, Drive My Car, which is at the other end of the spectrum, a three-hour Japanese movie. It doesn't even have its credit sequence until almost three quarters of an hour into its runtime. But that was such a baller moment because I looked at the runtime and thought, wow, I'm way more gripped by this than I thought I would be. Didn't know a lot going in, but that's a great film about art and the creation of art. But it's also about language, and it's about stories, and it's about how we communicate and how the subjective experience affects the interpretation of, you know, a well-worn piece of art and all that. I thought it was very sort of subtly done. It didn't hammer me over the head with a lot of that stuff, and builds to this sort of quietly really powerful climax. Like, there's a cut to black about 2 minutes before the end of the film that I thought was perfect. I thought it was brilliant. It's a brilliant, brilliant film. So if you can psych yourself up just for spending 3 hours with a subtitled movie, I thoroughly recommend Drive My Car. And I don't want to go on and on about films that I didn't like, but I will just mention two that I thought were extremely disappointing in 2022. Thor: Love and Thunder, I was thoroughly bored by. And it's curious to me that Taika Waititi can come off of making probably a top five MCU movie with Thor Ragnarok to make, in my mind, undoubtedly one of the bottom five MCU movies with Love and Thunder. I thought it was smug. I thought the action was completely unmemorable. I thought the jokes were unfunny. And I think quality control for Taika has gone out the window, and for the MCU in general, to be honest. It's not been a great year for them again. Yeah, so I think Taika, maybe chill out on all of the things that you're working on, because you're better than that. And the film that I really detested this year, the more I thought about it, was David O. Russell's Amsterdam, an $85 million bomb with one of the best casts of the year. And it started okay and got progressively worse from there. And in my mind, sort of the letterbox rating I was giving it started somewhere in the 3-3.5 range and ended up in the 1. Again, just a massive waste of talent, completely tedious, just awful, just an awful film. An awful, awful film that, like I say, got worse until it got to the end. Ignore it. It's a horrible thing to say that I'm glad a film died on its ass. But I understand David O. Russell isn't a particularly great person anyway. And shit like this should fail, frankly. So, there you go. So, with all that said, what are the films that I liked in 2022? Well, every year, people will tell you this was a great year for film. And some people say this was a terrible year for film. And I think this was a pretty good year for film. I'd say there are like 35 or 40 films that I would thoroughly recommend. I'm not going to go through all of those, but some films that I liked very, very much that I would recommend would be Confess Fletch, where John Hamm takes over from Chevy Chase. This film was horrifically marketed and made zero money, to my understanding, but is probably the best Fletch film there's been. And it'd be a real shame if we didn't see more of John Hamm in that role. The Lost Daughter and The Tragedy of Macbeth started off the year fairly strong. Jackass Forever was a reliably Jackass movie. I laughed a hell of a lot. George Carlin's American Dream, a very long but fairly in-depth and honest documentary about the shifting faces of George Carlin and his career and his legacy. Andrew Dominik's Blonde, very controversial film. One of those that has the whole gamut from 1-star to 5-star reviews. I would go somewhere around 4. I thought it was a difficult watch. I thought it was extremely well made, but it probably is my least favourite of Andrew Dominik's films. But I think worth seeing if you can stomach it. The Apology, which is a fantastic little horror film, I want to say. I think it's on Shudder, starring Anna Gunn from Breaking Bad and Linus Roach. And the Bookyak herself, Janine Garofalo. Very similar, to my mind, to the next two films that I'm going to mention, Alex Garland's Men and Resurrection, starring Rebecca Hall. Those three are all films about how shit men can be, but are more interesting than that. And I was fascinated by all three of them. Men has one of the most bonkers last acts I've seen in a mainstream movie for quite a long time. And Resurrection is worth seeing for Rebecca Hall alone, again. And Tim Roth as well. Again, a strange, strange third act to that one. Chippendale Rescue Rangers. The revival is excellent, suitable for kids, but it's definitely got that sort of Lego Movie, 22 Jump Street kind of vibe. Really, really enjoyed that. After just saying that the MCU had a bad year, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness was two different films. It was a totally formulaic Marvel movie half the time, and then it was a big budget Sam Raimi, let's just do some crazy shit, the other half of the time. And the Sam Raimi stuff I absolutely loved. So I saw it twice in the cinema. I enjoyed it both times. But it's very much two competing films. And one of them I like and the other I don't particularly. Boiling Point, starring Stephen Graham. A true one take, you know what I'm trying to say. Film set in a busy kitchen. Stressful. This year's Uncut Gems. Only not quite as good. Barbarian was the horror film that everybody was raving about this year. I liked it. I didn't adore it, but I thought it was better than sort of Smile and some of the other horror films that have come out this year. Although I liked Smile, you know, fine. But yeah, Barbarian is really good. Licorice Pizza, Paul Thomas Anderson, again, probably on the lower end of his spectrum of movies, but Paul Thomas Anderson not hitting it out of the park is still better than most directors at full tilt. There's just, as lots of people have addressed, there's some, I don't know, just kind of ugly humor in it around race that just really drags the film down. Because other than that, I thought it was delightful and has some excellent set pieces in it. And just outside of my top 20 for the year, Weird, the Al Yankovic story, starring Daniel Radcliffe. I'm a fully fledged member of the Church of Daniel Radcliffe now. I love him. I love the choices that he's making. And I thought this film was really, really entertaining. Definitely worth a shot. And if you've got a Roku stick, you can watch it for free on the Roku channel. So into the top 20. I'm just going to give you a little bit on each of these films. They are in order, but to be honest, all of these films are really strong recommendations. It's I would say the top five are bolted on five-star movies for me. But all of these are 4 stars and above.
At 20.
Lost Bullet 2, or Balle Perdue 2. Lost Bullet was a fairly low-budget French action movie that came out a few years ago. Did all of its stuff practically. Great stunts, great driving, all of that stuff. And Lost Bullet 2 is more of the same. Doesn't have a fight sequence as memorable as the first film had, but some stunning stunts. And I just want them to keep making these now. By all sort of indications, Lost Bullet 3 is definitely set up at the end of the film. I have seen no reason why it shouldn't get made, and I look forward to Netflumps. Have you heard of Netflumps? It's like Netflix, but it's made out of marshmallows. Hopefully Netflumps will deliver Lost Bullet 3 into my brain within the next 2 years. If you want a nice, crunchy, down-and-dirty action movie, Lost Bullet 2 is the one.
At 19...
Moon Age Daydream, or Bowie, Moon Age Daydream. This is the sort of artistic approach to telling the story of David Bowie to an extent. It's not a biopic and it's not really a documentary. It's more of an art film, to my mind. And it's good. It wasn't the one for me. I didn't absolutely adore it. And I think it's safe to say that's mostly because I didn't come out necessarily with a greater understanding of David Bowie as a person. As someone who would put David Bowie in my top five, like, artists of all time, essentially. So, To be fair, I probably read quite a bit about David Bowie over the years, and he's quite a mercurial character anyway, so maybe there's not much more to glean. I will also add the sort of proviso or disclaimer, whatever, that I went to see this in an IMAX cinema, and on my row was a middle-aged couple who were taking photos of the film while we were watching it, all through the film. If by any fluke, whatever, anyone who is listening to this knows who that middle-aged couple in Cheshire or North Wales who would go into a cinema and take film and photos, sometimes with the flash on, during a film, please tell them from me, fuck you. That's it, fuck you. I hate you. Yeah, you're a trash person. So anyway, Moon Age Daydream, it's fine. It's worth watching. It's a good movie. I think I went in with unrealistic expectations for what it could deliver.
At 18!
Nope. Jordan Peele's Nope. Saw this twice in the cinema in the space of a week, which might suggest that I loved it way more than I did. I really liked it. I probably liked it more than Us, but that's just because Us is a very challenging film, I thought. And not as much as Get Out, which is pretty much a modern classic. But the first time I saw Nope, I came away feeling like that was a spectacularly made film. It's very, very well shot and very well made, and I really enjoyed it. And there are some outstanding sequences in it, but it felt a little straightforward to me. And then I saw it again, and I realized everything under the surface that Jordan Peele is doing. And I didn't change my opinion of it necessarily in terms of quality, but I did. Well, no, that's wrong. It did change my opinion in terms of the quality. I came away feeling that's a much better film than I initially gave it credit for. Didn't necessarily change the way I feel about it in terms of how much I like it. And I like it a lot. If for nothing else, you should see how Hoyt van Hoytema shot this film. It's unreal. It's a gorgeous looking film, and then you find out how he shot the day for night sequences, and my mind was blown. But Nope is a film I will watch again. I think it's got high rewatchability. And I can't remember the name of the chimp in it, but the chimp sequence about halfway through the film, one of the best sequences of the year. Horrifying. Absolutely amazing. At 17. Elvis. Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. This was one of the biggest surprises for me this year. I went in not really expecting that much, because I'm not a huge Baz Luhrmann fan. I love Moulin Rouge, but since then he's not really made a film that I'd say I love that. And Elvis might be the one. I came out really, having really, really enjoyed it. On the one hand, Tom Hanks as Colonel Parker is absolutely ridiculous. There's no reason he should have been cast in that part. And there's no reason that that part should be designed and played in the way that it is. But balancing that is Austin Butler as Elvis, who is an absolute superstar. And I love his performance in this film. I thought he did an amazing job. Yeah, Elvis is just really good fun. Again, you're not gonna learn a lot more about the man, to be honest. But you are going to have a wild time for a couple of hours.
At 16.
Avatar, The Way of Water. Now, at the time of recording, it is the 1st of January 2023, and I've only seen this film once. The thing that I liked least about it, and again, I saw this in an IMAX 3D screening, was the variable frame rate. James Cameron is using different frame rates within the same scene, and high frame rate, to me, it still just makes the most expensive, glorious thing just look cheap and shit, and I want it to die. I'm sorry. My eyes are trained to watch films in a certain way, or my brain is, and it doesn't work for me, I'm afraid. So I need to see it again in 2D, where I believe high frame rate's just not a thing. Other than that, though, I loved this. I thought it was, in terms of quality, exactly as good as the first Avatar film, which I like a lot. Not a masterpiece, you know, 4 stars, but the expansion of the world, and also the characters. I found the characters in this far more interesting than in the first film. There's not enough Neytiri for my liking, because I think Zoe Saldana as Neytiri is excellent. But then, again, sort of balancing that out, Sam Worthington's really good in Avatar The Way of Water, and I don't feel that way about his performance in the first Avatar. And Sigourney Weaver's new character, Kiri, I adored. I thought she was the absolute heart of the film. I love the stuff that Cameron is doing with, you know, a father trying to protect his family and then the family saving the father, all that kind of stuff. Yes, he's painting on a large canvas with broad strokes. That's what Jim Cameron does. You're either into it or you're not at this point. Latter career Cameron, Titanic, the Avatar films, you don't go into them, to my mind, for extremely deep storytelling. You go to have a cinematic experience. And The Way of Water almost definitely tops the first Avatar for visual and aural experience. The middle hour of this film, where, you know, we really get into the water side of the world, I really loved it. I found myself welling up at times just through the sheer beauty of that world and the ideas that we're dealing with in that world. And then the third act is Cameron just showing you he still knows how to put a set piece together, and he's not going to try and do it with shaky cam and fast editing and that. He's just going to show you the geography of what's happening and let the characters fuck each other up. And fuck each other up they do, quite spectacularly. That's where Zoe Saldana's Neytiri comes in and saves the day with an absolutely awesome berserker sequence. So yeah, I can't wait to see this again, and I think I will probably love it more than the first film as it goes on. I think I probably already do, actually. I think there's more in it than there is in the first film. But yeah, you know before you see it whether you're going to like it or not. If you're on board with Avatar, you're going to enjoy this film.
At 15.
The Woman King. Just a lovely, straightforward, sort of gladiator-style movie, but with an almost entirely black cast, mostly led by women, Viola Davis and Lashana Lynch, the two leads of this film, with John Boyega in a bit of a supporting role. Great action sequences. One of the best soundtracks of the year for me, the score. I loved the score to this film. Viola Davis is obviously a boss. There's probably nothing she can't do. Yeah, loved this. Just really rousing, exciting, you know, violent, stirring. What more superlatives do you want? Again, if you're into films like Zulu and Gladiator and, you know, all those kind of things, The Woman King is a very, very good example of that genre. It's well made. It's got a good story. It's got good performances. It's a true story that a lot of people might not know about. Yeah, loved it. Recommend it. Can't wait to see it again.
A 14.
French Dispatch, which a lot of people would say was a 2021 movie, but it didn't come out in the UK until, I think, New Year's Day last year. Another one where I went in not necessarily expecting very much because Wes Anderson, I'm kind of on the fence about these days. I love The Royal Tenenbaums. I love Rushmore. I love The Life Aquatic. Didn't love, what was the train one? The Darjeeling Express or whatever, the Darjeeling Limited. Darjeeling Limited. I really didn't love that. Grand Budapest Hotel I had fun with, but I've never felt the need to go back and watch it again. And Isle of Dogs, I did not care for very much at all. It left me cold. So it surprised me when French Dispatch was done that I thought it's possibly his masterpiece. I'm always going to prefer a film like Rushmore, but French Dispatch is the most Wes Anderson-y Wes Anderson film you could imagine. Yes, there's an element of indulgence to that. But when something is so meticulously crafted as this, I would really struggle with anyone saying that's bad. I could understand someone saying they didn't like it. I loved it. Jeffrey Wright is probably the MVP for me. But again, one of the best casts of the year. David O. Russell, this is how you use a cast like this. You should learn from it. And everybody's on fire. Adrian Brody, Benicio Del Toro, Lea Seydoux. I'm not going to list the whole cast. It goes on forever. But yeah, everybody's doing great work in this. It's funny, but it's also smart. And it feels very personal, actually, in terms of what Wes Anderson is saying with this film. So yeah, loved it.
At 13.
Every pirate's favorite film, RRR. I can't remember exactly what the R's stand for. Something like Rise, Roar, Revolt. They're probably not in that order. This is a musical action superhero historical epic. It's a kitchen sink, just throw everything into the mix and have a fucking great time. And there's more energy in any frame of this film than pretty much all the other films of the year put together. There's song and dance sequences that are definitely better than what Spielberg did with his West Side Story this year, which on a technical level, it's impressive, but it left me pretty cold. And amazing action and beautiful like iconography. And it's a really, really good lesson, actually, to films like Fast and Furious, where those have gone. F9, I hated and I walked out of, because the way that they have taken, you know, violating the law of physics in their action scenes to 11-y stupid, as Mr. Kermode might say, it just feels so dull now and weightless and... I can't be invested when everybody's invincible and everything is impossible. And then you have a film like RRR where almost none of it's really believable, but there's still such impact in these wild sequences of people essentially flying, fighting animals, controlling the elements of fire and water. It's bonkers. It looks like Dragon Ball Z at times. And again, 3 hours long. But I've swept up in it. I don't know anyone who's seen this who hasn't come out of it just raving about how much fun they had. So I believe it's still on Netflix in the Hindi version. Definitely, definitely give it a chance. I guarantee you'll know within 10 or 15 minutes if this is the one for you. But if you can get on board with what this film is doing, I think you're going to have a wild time. It's just so much fun. And it made me feel exhausted watching these performers doing what they're doing for that amount of time.
At 12.
Now, this may be a little bit high. I think this is a film that I might drop down when I watch it again. I've seen it twice. Matt Reeves as the Batman. There are problems with this. There are definitely issues that I have with it. Some of them are about how it starts to retread ideas that the Christian Bale movies already dealt with, and some of it is, I think it's cool that there's a Batman film that looks like it was made by David Fincher, but I think Matt Reeves is a distinctive and interesting filmmaker on his own 2 feet, that he didn't need to lean quite as heavy into aping films like Zodiac and Seven as he does here. There's also a couple of logic leaps in the third act that I don't have a problem with them necessarily in terms of how the narrative evolves, but I think in the delivery, it's a little inelegant. And for a film that, again, is pushing 3 hours, it suddenly felt a little bit rushed in trying to get to its conclusion. All that said, Michael Giacchino's score for this is already iconic. The car chase is probably my favourite action scene of the year. the year of Colin Farrell. I love his performance as the Penguin. I think it's genuinely one of the highlights of the year for me. I kind of wish there was more of him in this. And Robert Pattinson, who I've never been a fan of, I think makes a pretty good Batman. I don't really care too much for his Bruce Wayne, but I think it, in the Bat outfit, he's doing a good job. Yeah, great set pieces, gorgeous looking film, really, really gorgeous, and it looks and sounds great. I just think it probably could have been trimmed by a good 20, 30 minutes. And some of those, like I say, less elegant moments probably could have fallen by the wayside.
At 11.
X, as in the letter X, by Ty West. I've seen a few of Ty West's films. House of the Devil is the one that leaps out to me. And I thought X was a real step up in terms of quality. I thought it was really interesting. It actually was a horror film that had something to do. It had something new to say, I think. I was intrigued by it on the level of what Ty West was saying as an author. And I found it very, very entertaining. I thought the performances it were great. Kid Cudi, where's he come from? He's great in this. And obviously Mia Goth, who's getting a lot of attention. So Pearl, the follow-up, has not come out in the UK yet. I believe it's coming out in February of 2023, which is a prequel to this, which I'm looking forward to. And then there's another third film, which I think is called Maxine, in 2023. But yeah, I loved X. I thought it was, again, another surprise. I didn't expect it to be as good as it was. And I don't want to spoil anything about it. It's a horror film that takes its time getting to the horror. And there's lots of other interesting stuff to keep you invested before the horror stuff turns up. Give it a chance if you're into horror films. Right, into the top 10 now. And like I say, all of these films are really massive recommendations now. At 10, All Quiet on the Western Front. It seems like you wait years for a good movie about World War I. And then two come along in the space of a couple of years. 1917 and this. I think this is probably even better than 1917, but this is an extremely brutal and extremely beautiful film. Yeah, it's ugly and beautiful. It's very powerful. It has obviously huge battle sequences in it, but they don't feel like action scenes. They feel more like epic horror set pieces, in a way. And a couple of them are memorable, not just for the way they're designed, but what the filmmaker is putting you through. This is a German language film, again, on Netflix, Netflumps. And I think it's probably going to win the best foreign language Oscar this year. There's talk that it may even get into the best picture category. And I think that is testament to how good this film is. It's being talked about in the same breath as Saving Private Ryan, for instance. It is long, again, another long one. It is difficult. It's certainly going to upset some people. But I thought it was fantastic. A genuinely great World War I movie that will enter the pantheon of probably the greatest war movies.
At 9.
This would probably be too low for some people. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Michelle Yeoh being talked about for an Oscar. Of course, I'm going to love that. Apologies if I destroy this pronunciation, but Kei Hui Kwan, known as Data from The Goonies and Short Round from The Temple of Doom, is all grown up and kicking ass. And he is fantastic in this film. He really is. And then Stephanie Hsu, I don't know how to pronounce that, HSU, apologies, is one of the really impressive newcomers of this year. From her kind of big entrance scene in this film, on which she is absolutely fantastic, and I hope she gets good work going forward, because she's clearly very, very talented. This film is extremely funny. It's very, very clever. It's very convoluted. It's the Daniels who did Swiss Army Man, the farting Daniel Radcliffe corpse movie. I think this is probably a better film than that. It's certainly more ambitious and more epic. It has some stunning action scenes in it, some stunning philosophical ideas, some stunning cinematic moments that you'll find yourself moved by without really being able to understand how they managed to do that. I just stop short of giving it the full 5-star treatment, because I think it runs a little long. And for me, it sets such a breakneck pace that it's probably necessary to slow things down a little bit in the third act. But for me, it just felt like you were really barreling towards this thing ending, and now you're stretching out a little bit. But having said that, I've only seen it once. So when I see it again, I may change my mind about that. All of that said, some of my favorite gags in the year. There are moments in this film that when I think about them, I can't help but chuckle. And I saw it in March or April, whenever it came out. Michelle Yeoh is a living god, frankly. Certainly a legend. Everyone involved in this. Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, I love. So it's always nice to see her in an interesting role. She's in obviously multiple roles in this film, as everybody is. There's a lot to love here. I think, again, it was one of those where I just went in with the expectation that this will be my favorite film of all time. Probably something like that, or one of my favorite films of all time, or certainly one of my favorite films of the year. And it's, you know, my ninth favorite film of the year. So it's a small, tiny, tiny disappointment that may be corrected when I see it again.
At eight.
Nightmare Alley, Guillermo del Toro. I don't know where to start with this film. It's, again, like All Quiet on the Western Front, one of those films that's so beautiful to look at and yet so desperately dark. It's so fucking bleak, this film. Probably my favourite Bradley Cooper performance. One of my favourite Cate Blanchett performances. I really don't know what to say about this. It's probably my top three Guillermo del Toro movies. I think Shape of Water, Pan's Labyrinth, are probably better than this, but this is up there. You know, I prefer this to Crimson Peak, for instance. It's so, so beautifully made, and it's dealing with a set of characters that feel exciting to be around. And even if, you know, the sort of the twists and turns along the way are fairly easy to guess, I think the way that they're delivered is still exceptional. And Bradley Cooper's performance, especially his final scene in this, is that should silence anyone who thinks he's overrated or you know, not as talented as he is pretty. He is extremely pretty, but he is extremely talented. So, Nightmare Alley, pretty tough, pretty violent at times, and a pretty long film as well, but an exceptional artistic achievement from one of the best working.
At seven.
Prey, P-R-E-Y. I don't think this time last year I even knew this film existed. One of the great shames of 2022 is that so few people were given the opportunity to see this in the cinema. I don't think it received a theatrical release in America or Britain. I think it may have done in other parts of Europe. And there were cinema screenings for critics. But otherwise, this was dumped on Hulu and Disney Plus. And if you don't know what Prey is, it's a Predator film that takes place 200 years before Predator. It takes place in the native peoples of America during the period of colonization or just obliteration. And you throw into that a predator who has more advanced technology than the humans do, but doesn't have the kind of advanced technology that the predator that fought Arnold Schwarzenegger has, because it's coming from 200 years earlier within their own civilization. This is from Dan Trachtenberg, who did 10 Cloverfield Lane. And any long-time listeners to this podcast will know that both Alex and I adore 10 Cloverfield Lane. And Dan Trachtenberg gets it. He's one of us. He doesn't seem to be cynical. When he gets his hand on an established IP or a property, he wants to make the best version of that with all of the ideas that fans argue about, the possibilities, you know, all that kind of stuff. This is inarguably the best Predator film since 1987. And I like Predator 2. I'll defend that movie. But this extends the lore of what the Predator is and can be. It's totally respectful to what came before cinematically and after chronologically. The performance of Amber Midthunder in the lead role, Naru, is just astonishing. Like, to my mind, a first-timer, or certainly a newcomer to my eyes anyway, of a brilliant physical performance. So much in that performance. And it's just a kick-ass action film. It's a gory Predator movie. It's absolutely brilliant. It deserved much better. This is definitely a film I'll be watching many, many more times over the coming years. I'd quite happily watch a sequel to it. And Dan Trachtenberg deserves much better than he has been treated in the last 10 years. Get a sequel to this made. Get Dan Trachtenberg making it. and stick it in the cinemas, for Christ's sake.
At six.
Glass Onion, Knives Out Mystery. A lot of people saying they prefer this to Knives Out, and I don't think I'm quite there with it. I will say I think it's every bit as clever as Knives Out, and is almost inarguably a funnier film. But as much as I love this cast, Edward Norton, Dave Bautista, Leslie Odom Jr., Kate Hudson, I don't think it can hold a candle to the first cast and how they work together. All of that said, Rian Johnson is the only person making modern murder mysteries that are still exciting and original and surprising. This is a very, very, very entertaining film. It's bigger, it's louder, and it's just as subversive as Knives Out was. It's crammed with social commentary. It's basically a two-hour diss track to Elon Musk, which makes me very happy. Brick! And yeah, it's just loads and loads of fun. Daniel Craig is swinging for the fences again. Can't wait to see another one of these, and I just hope that they keep it fresh. I think if they can knock out one of these every 2 to 3 years, I think most people will be really happy. So roll on, Knives Out 3. But I just didn't think it was as good as the first Knives Out, that's all. Right, we're into the top five now, baby.
At five.
The Northman. Now, there's very few surprises in the story of The Northman. That is because it is a legend that has been around for about 1,000 years. It's so old, it predates and inspired Hamlet. Okay? Robert Eggers is doing something with his body of work, so The Witch, The Lighthouse, where he is taking stories and characters from mythology and telling them in the most surreal and expressive and heavy metal ways possible. This is a very, very heavy metal film. This is by far his most expensive film. I'm so glad I got the opportunity to see this in the cinema because it's epic. It's huge. And the vistas look incredible. The action, I really like the action and the way that Eggers is shooting it. But it's not, you know, Mad Max Fury Road. It's not tightly choreographed action in that sense. But I really enjoyed the set pieces in this. But more so the visual storytelling that he's brought to this, especially in the final scenes, it's so gorgeous. It looks absolutely phenomenal. And I think Alexander Skarsgård as Amleth is the kind of performance that's always, it's not going to get the recognition that I think it deserves. Again, it's a very physical performance, but his character is very straightforward. He has very simple beliefs. He's quite, you know, black and white in that sense. There's good things and there's bad things. And Skarsgård commits to that character. He doesn't try and give that character more depth than he actually has. This is, you know, a mythological kind of legend. And I think he's riveting. I think he's a force of nature in this film. I absolutely love his performance in this. And he's back to... Anya Taylor-Joy is fine in this. I didn't think she necessarily had the greatest part. Nicole Kidman, in one scene in particular, is absolutely awesome. But the big sort of takeaway from this for me was Kleist Bang as Fjolnir, the subject of Alexander Skarsgård's revenge. I thought he was phenomenal. I was absolutely engrossed every time he was on screen. And having subsequently seen him in Bad Sisters on Apple TV, unrecognizable as the same actor. So I'm very excited to follow the career of Kleist Bang. A big old Viking, gory, beautifully shot, epic action adventure. You're not going to get too many of these. Don't think this made that much money, so we should just be grateful that someone gave Eggers the budget to make this film in the way that he did. From that point of view, I think this is a very special film. Make a great double bill with The Woman King, actually. I might do that.
At four.
Top Gun Maverick. Now, I'll just start by saying this is the film from 2022 that I've seen the most times. I saw it twice in the cinema, once as part of a Top Gun double bill, and I've watched it a couple of times at home as well. I will actually say that at home, I enjoyed it probably more than I did in the cinema, despite how much this is a cinematic experience. And that's because the 4K disc for Top Gun Maverick is the best quality I have ever seen on a home video release to date. If you have a 4K player and you don't have the Top Gun Maverick disc, you're wasting your time. It's far and away the best looking and sounding disc that I own. So there's that. But I just love the decisions that they made in this. It's such a straightforward story. There's a mission. We're going to train for the mission. And then we're going to go on the mission. That's it. And because it's so simple, Joseph Kosinski and Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise, the three sort of creative minds driving this thing, are able to fill in all of these lovely little details. The fact that Jennifer Connelly's character is technically someone that Maverick has been having dalliances with since before he met Kelly McGillis's character from the first film, Penny Benjamin. The way that Iceman is brought back into this film, and specifically Val Kilmer, how that's dealt with, I thought was very, very well judged. The idea that there are two separate points in this film where it looks like the filmmakers are trying to fake you out on the idea that Tom Cruise has just been killed. And instead of going through all of those motions, in the next cut, they just let you know, nah, Tom Cruise isn't dead. You didn't really think we were going to kill Tom Cruise anyway, did you? So why try and pull the wool over your eyes? Yeah, he's still alive. Don't worry, there's a lot more film to come. I love that. And the realization that once the mission has been carried out, mild spoilers for Top Gun Maverick if you haven't seen it here. Once the mission's been carried out, the filmmakers let you know, oh, don't worry, there's more. We're not ending there, there's more. And that, for me, was so exciting. There's a lot, when I realized there was another 20, 30 minutes to this film, and what those 20 or 30 minutes were, really exciting. So all of that is without even addressing the fact that this probably has the best third act to any blockbuster, any Hollywood movie since Mad Max Fury Road. Some all-time remarkable shots achieved with real planes. In Tom Cruise's case, sometimes Tom Cruise literally flying those planes. A really, really brilliant blend of practical and digital effects that is done in such a way that you simply stop looking for the seams and you just let the film blow your mind with what you're watching. Yeah, it's corny in places and there's a couple of things in it that I think are a little bit lazy, but certainly not in terms of trying to deliver an action spectacular. And this is right up there with the very best of what Tom Cruise has delivered in that genre over the last 15, 20 years. You know, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Mission Impossible Fallout. Is it better than Top Gun? Yeah, probably is. It's probably a better film. You can't really argue with 35 years worth of nostalgia for that film, though. But having seen them back to back in a double bill, it works absolutely fine as a sequel. I mean, the first time I saw it, that was one of the things I really loved about it as well. Apart from the fact that Tom Cruise is three decades older, if they had made Top Gun 2 in, you know, 1988, 1989, I don't think the story would have been that much different to this. It really feels like an honest 80s sequel, just with 2020s technology. And that is a very, very potent mix.
A three.
The worst person in the world. And again, apologies if I murder the pronunciation of this, but Renata Reinsve, the lead actor in this, I think is one of the performances of the year. I thought a beautifully done performance, deep, soulful, subtle, rich. All of these things are true. I think I initially described this to someone when I was recommending it to them as if Amelie was kind of sad. That sounds stupid now. But it has that same kind of like filmmaking energy of a film like Amelie. It moves at a pace and has these sort of fantastical sequences, these flights of fancy and all of that, in the same way that Amelie did. But this is dealing with much sort of more realistic emotions. There's some pretty tough stuff in this that will be triggering for some people. But it just does so much. It really feels like a novel in that regard. It crams so much into its runtime. It is sad and it is beautiful. And it's oddly entertaining, you know, considering some of the subject matter. I can't really say what it's about. I guess it's kind of a romantic drama in the sense that it is about love and letting go and all that kind of stuff. But it's more than that. Yeah, I feel like this is a nothing burger of a review for this film, but just know that with all of the films that I've talked about, I've put this at number 3 for the entire year, and I could see some people putting it number 1. It's a very, very, very good film. Give it a watch. Now, the top 2, to be fair, are completely interchangeable. I put number 1 where I did because it had the greater emotional impact on me, and I've seen both films twice. So at 2 is The Banshees of Inisherin. I think this is far and away Martin McDonagh's best film. If the name Martin McDonagh doesn't mean too much to you straight away, In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. In Bruges, I'd say, is my favourite of those three, and I think Banshees is better than that. Colin Farrell has had an extraordinary year between this and Playing the Penguin and After Yang and whatever that Ron Howard diving movie was. I can't remember what it was called. But yeah, he has had an extraordinary year, and I think it's a two-horse race between him and Brendan Fraser for who's going to win the Oscar this year. His performance in this is everything. He's funny. It's, you know, he's sad and he's nice and he's mean, tragic and all of that. And he just does such an amazing job with this. Brendan Gleeson, you know what you're getting. He's just always good. And there's just more Brendan Gleeson goodness here. Fans of Calvary, there is a scene involving Brendan Gleeson and a confession box. So that made me very happy. But even more so than that, I think from Martin McDonagh's point of view, there's a visual acuity to this in terms of the information that he delivers to you visually alongside the masterpiece of a script that he's written, you know, structurally and in terms of how it delivers information and comedy and tragedy. It really is something to be studied and admired in terms of the script writing. But he's brought this visual sense that I think, not to say that his other films didn't, you know, have that, but for me it was much more striking in this film. And some people will say that's just about the location. He does shoot the location really, really well. But I'm really more talking about his framing and his movement or non-movement of cameras and the way that he delivers information through those things besides his script. And then on top of that, you then have the absolutely heartbreaking performances of Barry Keoghan and Kerry Condon. Barry Keoghan has been killing it for years in things like Chernobyl, Killing of a Sacred Deer, Dunkirk, and he briefly appeared as the Joker in Matt Reeves' Batman as well, which is probably my least favourite thing that he's done. I could see him getting Best Supporting Actor for this, for one scene alone, which he shares with Kerry Condon, who is probably the person who's going to get the least hype this awards season out of this film. And that's a real shame, because when I saw Banshees for the second time, I realised what a beautiful performance she's giving and how important her character is to everything that's going on around her, the characters that we're really following, and how she plays into the events of this film. Yeah, four great performances leading this film, and there's a roster of supporting characters and actors that are great as well. It's just that brilliant, brilliant balance of comedy and tragedy. It's a deeply sad film in so many ways, this, and it has some of the funniest lines of 2022. I think it's Martin McDonagh's best film to date, and he is one of the best screenwriters, playwriters working. Yeah, Banshees, I think, is probably my favourite film of 2022. But the film that I'm putting at number one, and again, in America, this may have been a 2021 movie, is Mass, directed by Fran Kranz. Fran Kranz is best known, I think, as the stoner, I think his character was called Marty, in Cabin in the Woods, the guy who's got like a bong that looks like a Starbucks cup. And he has written and directed this film, Mass, which is, for the most part, a four-hander between Jason Isaacs, Martha Plimpton, Ann Dowd, and Reed Birney. And I'm not going to spoil anything about this. I would also say probably don't watch the trailer, because there's a big spoiler in the trailer. You can probably work out what the film is about, but I would say let it do its thing to you. The reason I put this at number one is I think it is talking about things that people find very difficult to talk about without appealing to base emotions. And that's also one of the things that this film is talking about, is when something is so emotional to talk about, how can we do so with reason and logic and not get emotional? And that's one of the conflicts within the film. But there are multiple moments in this film that absolutely destroyed me emotionally. I was a blubbering wreck at the end of this film. And I think it's a real shame that this didn't get more awards notice last year, because I think Jason Isaacs is extraordinary. I think Ann Dowd is equally extraordinary in this film. But all four of those actors get moments that are just unbelievably difficult and emotionally complex. From Frank Kranz's point of view as a writer-director, I think he did. He delivered this in a very mature and very sober way, and it's not a preachy film at all, but it's clear that he got across what he wanted to say whilst also trying to be balanced and fair with it. I just thought it's a very rare film, Mass. It's one of the most emotionally affecting films I've seen in a very, very long time. I believe in the UK it's available on Sky. I think that's where I saw it. Give it a go. But just strap in knowing that it's going to hurt you before you get to the end, but it also might make you a better person. And that is a very rare film indeed. So, there we go. That was my year of 2022 in film. Just to run that down, from 20 to 1. At 20, Lost Bullet 2. 19, Moon Age Daydream. At 18, Nope. At 17, Elvis. At 16, Avatar The Way of Water. At 15, The Woman King. 14, The French Dispatch. At 13, RRR. At 12, The Batman. At 11, X. At 10, All Quiet on the Western Front. At 9, Everything Everywhere All at Once. 8, Nightmare Alley. 7, Prey. At 6, Glass Onion. At 5, The Northman. 4, Top Gun Maverick. At 3, The Worst Person in the World. At 2, The Banshees of Inisherin. And at 1, Mass. That was my year in 2022. What is there to look forward to in 2023? Well, lots. All those films, like I said, haven't come out yet. Plus, we get Dune 2. Dune Part 2, I should say. Which I'm very, very excited about. And a new Mission Impossible film. The penultimate Mission Impossible film, perhaps. Dead Reckoning Part 1. Those are probably the two that I'm most excited for. But there's loads of other stuff as well. One of the earliest releases in January is Megan, or M3 Gun, produced by James Wan from my beloved Malignant, and that just looks like a whole lot of fun. Knock at the Cabin is the new M. Night Shyamalan movie. Ant-Man and the Wasp, not really bothered. Cocaine Bear, come on. Saw the trailers for Plane and Cocaine Bear in succession before Violent Night, and I'm just very excited for the resurgence of the mid-budget genre movie, to be honest. Creed 3, very excited for that. Love that series. Michael B. Jordan directing is extremely exciting. Scream 6, which looks to be like Scream doing Jason Takes Manhattan. Yeah, fine. John Wick Chapter 4, more of the same. Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. Technically looks kind of shit, but I just love Chris Pine, and he seems to be very charming in it. Renfield. Starring Nicolas Cage as Dracula, I'm into it. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, hopefully I'm into that. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Into the Spider-Verse was probably the best Spider-Man film of all time. So, big act to follow, but psyched for it. Transformers Rise of the Beasts, I don't really care, but it looks like fun. Indiana Jones 5, who knew that that could actually be exciting, but it looks really good. And in James Mangold we trust. Barbie, I've no idea what that is, but I'll watch it. Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan. Hit and miss for me, but that trailer looks absolutely fantastic. Next Call wins, hopefully an increase in quality from Taika Waititi. Yeah, that's about it. That's enough. I'm sure I'll talk about some of it over the next year. What did you think of my list? What did your list look like? Feel free to get in touch, theornithology@gmail.com, with your comments, feedback, lists, whatever you like. You can also follow me on Letterboxd, where I create all kinds of lists. And I'm Ben Hyton on Letterboxd, so that should be quite easy to find. H-I-G-H-T-O-N. I guess that's it. Like I said, we'll definitely be back at some point in 2023 with more offerings. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you had a good year. Here's to this year being a better one. Save the NHS. It's so important that we do that and we don't let it become a private insurance-based healthcare system. So definitely support nurses and do what you can to support the NHS. That would be my message. Thanks for listening, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye.